introduced to me the literary performance of her own.
Peggy Shinner's stories have appeared in numerous publications, including Triquarterly, Western Humanities Review, Other Voices, ACM, Sojourner, and Her Face in the Mirror, Jewish Women on Mothers and Daughters. She's been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and was a finalist in a Glimmer Train short story contest. She is on the faculty of the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, and she also teaches fiction and literature in Chicago, from where she visits us this evening by train. Peggy Shinner.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here tonight. Can you hear me? Yes? I'm going to be reading two stories. Consummation. Why do I open this frosted glass door? Why do I take my place among the other waiting women, among our frazzled beating hearts? I give my name to the receptionist because I want to accomplish something. I want to make my mark on this world, this small world flanked in spring by straggly yellow forsythia bushes, in winter by piles of dirty snow and dog shit, and in any season by block after block of right-angled city streets and sun-whitened alleys, airplanes rumbling on a flight path overhead, and a blue sky streaked with cirrus. I want to make a mark, however slight, however small, even if, in the end, to some it looks like a question mark, a mark of faltering and dubious distinction. And to some it will, because of course I have my detractors. I have my mother who, even in the grave, manages to deride my accomplishments. No matter, I'm going to have a baby, this baby. I've decided. I'm going to carry something to term. In the years which add up, I've been a carpenter and a sound tech and a potter. Now I sit in front of a computer and learn the C language. Once I wanted to be a poet. I imagined the taste of words on my tongue, the tripping of rhymes in my ear, but I'm going to opt for the suck and pull of a greedy mouth on my inverted nipples instead. I'm going to spread my legs and let fate swim in, an X or Y chromosome. I'm ready for it, whichever. Let this, the future, ripen. I'll deliver it. Have I ever composed anything? Many times now, as often as the sun comes up, I'd like to say. But frankly, I am not a tireless worker. I am not the busiest bee. I am just a woman with the normal number and kinds of neuroses who's been to her share of shrinks and wants to have something to show for it. At 35, I'm ready for a minor consummation. And my mother? My mother wanted me to be beautiful. She wanted me to shine like a beauty queen. When I was born with a beauty mark, like a chocolate kiss on my belly, she thought it was an omen. And young hopeful that I was, I'd always wanted to agree. I'd watched the pageants year after year, Miss America and Miss Universe, and I fancied myself growing up like the 5'7" finalists, with flat stomachs and firm buttocks who glowed with earnestness and said that humility was the most important quality in a woman. Instead, I was merely average. My hair and eyes were brown, and, according to my mother, my thoughts were dark. I was sullen, she said, and moody, and not even unconventionally attractive. But here they don't care what you look like. They ask you a modicum of questions. They only care about your desire to bear and your ability to pay, and the pattern of your 6-month temperature chart. No one says, "Will you be a good mother? Will you love your baby?" In this waiting room, we all sit patiently on the shabby donated furniture, corduroy sofa and Indian print chairs, And although none of us yet has her hands folded over her belly, I imagine it. Swollen hands, swollen bellies. Many of us read magazines, and as I look over the top of mine at the well-thumbed covers of Harper's, Highlights, Off Our Backs, and Parenting, what a crowd, I think, all of us women wanting babies. The first time I heard of AI was in Scrabble. AI, a three-toed sloth. Harry, Mom, and I played when my father went bowling, and at the end of the game, when I was left with a few stray vowels, there was always some place for that two-bit word to slither its way onto the board. And then there was artificial intelligence, which my mother, had she heard of it, might have accused me of having. She did say once, "You have no common sense." But now I know that AI stands for artificial insemination, the only kind I'll ever know. And my mother's reliable voice pipes up again. "We got pregnant the old-fashioned way," I imagine her saying. "We screwed." Myra, my ex, said she didn't want a baby. She never did, and she never will, she said. Her parents, Polish refugees who'd met in Treblinka, owned a woman's discount clothing store named after her, Myra's, and all her life she'd experienced this as an outrage. "Myra's finer boutique," she said, but there was nothing fine about it. She worked there after school and on weekends, but refused to wear any of the clothes. She rang up sales in a rage. When the store closed, after its profits, she admitted, put her through college, she got a seat on the Chicago Board of Trade. Sometimes she bought and sold sugar, and occasionally grain. "If you want a baby," Myra said to me, "I'm out of here." And she was. When I came here for the first time 6 months ago, when I met with my personally assigned health worker, she didn't call it artificial insemination. She called it alternative. Today, I am here to be alternatively inseminated. I've faithfully recorded my body's temperature every morning for the last 6 months, its little spikes and minor lows. And I know, as much as I know anything, that on the 16th day of every cycle, my left or right ovary releases its bundle of albumin and expectation. I pick up the consent form, which has been sitting in my lap. I read it once, and then again. Myra is gone, my mother is dead, the C language, it turns out, is as foreign as any, and quote, "I, Arona Hankin," the consent form says, "authorize the Feminist Women's Health Center to perform one or more alternative inseminations with sperm obtained from an anonymous donor for the purpose of making me pregnant." I dig a pen out of the bottom of my purse and sign in my perfectly illegible handwriting. "Raise your hips," my health worker says. My health worker's name is Anna, a name that at this moment sounds more motherly and fecund than any I have ever heard. But Anna is no nonsense. "We've got to help those little buggers swim right in there," she says. She fluffs up two pillows with her large knuckled hands and slides the pillows underneath me. For a second, I imagine her cupping me, and then I shake my head. "Everything okay?" Anna asks. "Fine," I say. "Perfect. You comfortable?" she says. "As comfortable as can be. But I can't get into the right position. My feet are in stirrups padded with quilted oven mitts, the kind mothers use to pull sheets of chocolate chip cookies out of the stove, although mine never did." Shifting around on the pillows, I'm still thinking of Anna's hands. They look like they've been places, and I want to know where. But this is not the sort of question you ask someone. "Show me your hands." Myra's, which have been all over my body, are short and childlike, and they flare out at the fingertips. They reminded me of how vulnerable she was when I was prone to forget. My mothers were like birds, always moving. Anna, with her large hands and graceful body, is now defrosting the sperm. She is telling me this as she takes the straw out of the tank of liquid nitrogen and gently runs it under warm water. Not too hot, she says, testing the water first on her wrist. I watch the narrow ice floe begin to melt, and as the tiny pieces separate and float up and down the straw, I wonder what it is the bewildered creatures feel swimming back to the surface after their frozen slumber. If you're not careful, Anna says, you can kill these. Anna's getting the Milex cup to fit over my cervix, and I'm taking inventory. Isn't it a little late, my mother might say. My mother was a beautiful woman who died when something got caught in her throat. The doctor said cancer of the larynx, but I'm not so sure. I think it was my life she couldn't swallow. She had two children, one miscarriage, and one husband. Of these, I don't know which or how many she loved. That's a secret she took with her. But for the time being, this much is clear. My eyes are brown, my hair is hennaed now, and my mucus, Anna has confirmed, looking under the microscope, is definitely fertile. I live alone in a two-bedroom apartment and ride the L as it lurches to work in the morning and home at night. In the hours between, my fingers slide along a keyboard, and I watch what floats up on the screen. Are you ready? Anna says. Am I ready? I tell her to go ahead. I pay attention to every detail. The speculum working into my vagina, the Milex cup on my cervix, Anna smiling, putting in the straw, the sperm swimming at whatever speed they swim. I notice the molded plastic dilation chart on the wall next to my head, the os at 1 centimeter, 2 centimeters, stretching to 5, 7, and finally 10. I remember how once, when Myra and I were making love, I slipped my fingers, one at a time, inside her, until her whole hand filled me up, and then I turned my fist against until my whole hand filled her up. And then I turned my fist against those pink inside walls, and it felt like my hand was pushing up through her entire body, reaching into her throat, taking her breath away. This next story is one of a series of stories I've written about an old Jewish guy named Jack, from the time of his widowhood to his death. They always call when you're not home. When he stepped off the elevator, he thought he heard ringing. A phone ringing. A phone was ringing, that's for sure. Who's the lucky one, he heard Mrs. Whatever her name is say as the elevator door closed behind him. Lucky enough, she probably meant, to get a call from one of their ungrateful kids. After all, they've got their own lives, she probably said. With his head cocked, he stopped to listen. It was like his piss hitting the toilet. At first, you don't even notice until some guy standing next to you in the john at that steak joint, and suddenly that steady stream whizzes in your ears. It's the only thing you hear. Lately, he'd been wondering about his prostate. 2-3 times a night, he felt the urge to go, but when he got up, he just stood over the bowl and waited. He guessed the steady stream was not so steady anymore. Ha, ha, ha. He should make an appointment about it, but boy, did he hate that examination. Besides, what would Lowenstein tell him? It's not working so good, Jack? He'd hung out a shingle to tell him that? A phone was ringing, he would swear. That's the thing about living in one of these high-rises. You park the car in the garage, take the groceries out of the trunk, stop at the mailboxes, nothing but a bill for your monthly assessments and the return address stickers with the smiling faces you got from the Crusade of Mercy in exchange for your tax-deductible donation. Walk through the lobby where maybe you bump into someone, another Altacocker. This time it's Irv Gross, one of your poker pals, a widower like yourself. Kibitz a little, did you watch the game last night? What's on sale at the Dominic's? Gerstein and 708, he had a bypass. Then in the elevator, all the way up to the 16th floor. You never lived so high up before. You lived in a house or a six flat or the back of a store. Up until 6 months ago, you lived on Bernard Street, where you'd lived for almost 32 years. Jesus, it takes forever, and that old bag, whatever her name is, doesn't stop talking. And when you get off, a phone is ringing, and you don't even know for how long. He stopped to listen. For a second, that's all. For the time it took to shift the groceries from one arm to the other. Resting in front of the elevator, breathing a little heavily, sweating. He was no spring chicken, but not bad for his age. Not bad. Yeah, a phone was ringing. He heard the ring of silence down the hallway like he always heard it, and then like a knife cutting through it, the sound of a telephone ringing in his ears. Sure he heard it. Was it his phone, his apartment, at the end of the hallway, number 1601? He told his legs to hurry. They were old and tired, and he had to wear support hose to sleep and elevate his feet, and he walked as fast as he could. Static from the tight wove carpet made his pant legs cling. He remembered how he used to ride the stationary bike. You pump and pump, and it feels like you're not getting anywhere, and then, 20 minutes later, you're there. Why did he stop? One day he got tired, but he told his daughter he still rode it so she wouldn't nag him anymore. She was the expert on his life. 3 times a week, he said. Who could be calling? Yesterday they called from the podiatrist's office to reschedule his appointment. He'd been taking a little snooze when a miserable time of it he'd had the night before. Looking at the clock, turning on the radio, Milt Rosenberg going on and on with that white supremacist. What a no-class moron. Maybe he'd go back to the Halcyon. Half a pill, that's no big deal. Lowenstein had said it was okay. But Cheryl said, you'd take sleeping pills like he was some kind of addict. She could fall asleep with her eyes open. What did she know? There'd been a death in the family, the receptionist said. Death in the family, Jack thought. What was the time? He must have dozed off for a couple of minutes. Dr. Krivit won't be back in the office until Tuesday, the receptionist said. Tuesday, Jack repeated. He shook out his head. What time on Tuesday? When Muriel died, Krivit made a contribution to the Women's American Ort. A guy like him, a foot doctor, he didn't have to do that, Jack had thought. He'd go to Harmony Hall and get Krivit a condolence card. In a desk drawer in the den, he'd kept all Muriel's condolence cards. Just last week, he'd read them over. Let us know if we can do anything, Jack. We're thinking of you in your time of bereavement. In the love that surrounds you, may you find strength. In the memories you cherish, may you find peace. To this day, he had no use for anyone who hadn't sent one. Join a group, Cheryl urged after Muriel died, so you can meet others in the same situation, so you can talk about it. He'd even cut out a notice from the Lerner newspaper. Widow to widower group. What do I do now? But he never called, because what would those people have to tell him that he didn't know already? They probably sat around and bawled their eyes out. So who could it be? The hallway was pressing in on him like an underpass. Everybody had their door closed. The phone was still ringing, and he wasn't even halfway there. When he passed the Fabers in 1608, he saw a gift-wrapped delivery of flowers on the floor outside their door. A purple stem stuck out of the wrapping. What was the occasion? Was Mr. Faber surprising his wife with flowers? If he was, the old guy should have known better. Sure, they smelled good for a couple days, but flowers didn't last. With the sleeve of his jacket, Jack rubbed his forehead. His feet pushed ahead. Go, he said. A couple months ago, his car stalled in a flooded viaduct on the way back from the warehouse club, and he'd had to walk knee-deep in water to call AAA for help. Trash swirled around him. The water dragged his pants down. He'd lifted one foot in front of the other. Go. Why didn't you tell me, Cheryl said weeks later, when he finally mentioned what had happened. But all he said was, I'm telling you now. You could have drowned, his son Larry said when they talked over the phone long distance. I could have, Jack had said. But he didn't. And now somebody was trying to reach him. He could count out the possibilities on his fingers of one hand. His daughter Cheryl, who got so many calls she needed an answering machine. Sometimes he called her and left a message. Give me a call sometime. One of his poker buddies, wanting to bum a ride to the game. The dry cleaners, because he'd left his cleaning there over 30 days. Aunt Lil. Lil, she never called. She sat on her throne in her Gold Coast apartment and waited for him to call. Okay, let her wait. Maybe it was the insurance company. They were calling because he still owed them on the plate glass insurance. He'd gotten the bill a month ago but hadn't paid. Why should he pay? It was such a ripoff, and he wanted them to beg. What did he need plate glass insurance for? To look out the window and see the sights? That's what the real estate agent had said when she sold him the place. Enjoy the view. Sit on the terrace. Watch the stars. $12 semi-annually for insurance. What for? In case he threw himself out the window? Ha, ha, ha. Don't talk like that, Cheryl would say. But he was only joking. Boy, these groceries were heavy, and getting heavier every year. Who said he didn't have a sense of humor? Larry, L.A. Larry, his son, the West Coast hotshot. He never called either. You could count on that. Lighten up, Larry said the last time they talked, when Jack tried to talk to him about money, when he tried to tell him a thing or two. Lighten up. Was that how they talked out there? Larry thought money was a cash crop in California. He thought it was the gold rush. He probably ate kiwi fruit, whatever that was. When Larry first told him he was moving to California to be near the ocean, Jack pointed in the direction of Lake Michigan and said, "What do you need the ocean when we've got all the water you could possibly want out here?" Jack tightened his grip on the grocery bag. He jostled it around. How much did Larry pay for groceries? He paid $30 for a haircut. He bought bottled water. He got himself a leather briefcase with a monogram. A monogram, so he could see himself coming and going. What was wrong with the briefcase Jack gave him, the one that he got as a premium at the bank? His son didn't know a thing about money. $20 for assorted sundries, and what did Jack have to show for it? 3 heads of lettuce, a couple packages of all-beef hot dogs, 2 Lean Cuisine chicken breast entrees at Cheryl's insistence because she was always harping on him about cholesterol. Okay, let her harp. At the checkout counter, he picked up a copy of Sports Illustrated, Larry Bird on the cover, ugliest guy in basketball, but what a jump shot. And Larry Kamen, what kind of son was he? He didn't even pay attention to sports. The door to 1605 cracked open. Mrs. Weiss peeked out, a dump of a woman. Nosy? She almost made him drop the grocery bag. What a busybody. She stood at her peephole all day for excitement. Always asking questions. Did he have children? Was he retired? What business of yours, Mrs. Horseface? 69 years old, and though he'd been in business for himself for years, now he worked as a cashier, changing sawbucks in a car wash. Should he be proud? Once he'd play poker with her husband, Eddie Weiss, Dr. Eddie Weiss, a heart man, thought he knew everything, had no card sense, played like flush was a medical condition. If it was football, they'd have called him for delay of game. Ah, Mr. Kamen, check. That's right, isn't it? I heard footsteps. I thought I would check. It's always better to take a peek. I see you went grocery shopping. Did you pick up any bargains? I saw in the paper naval oranges are on sale at the Dominick's, 35 cents a pound. Oh, you have some there, she said, pointing to his bag. A very good buy, she nodded, wiping her hands on the towel. Jabber. Couldn't she hear that his phone was ringing? He didn't have time for her nonsense. What if they hung up? Bargains. At Dominick's, there'd been some fresh pineapple in the fruit section, all cut up. When no one was looking, he'd snatched a few chunks. Maybe he could sneak a look into her apartment. The mirror in the foyer was all steamed up. Was she cooking the doctor a little something for his dinner? He took a whiff. Pot roast. It smelled like pot roast. When was the last time he ate pot roast for dinner? It watered in his mouth. You should get some, Ada, Jack said, nodding his chin at the oranges and walking past her. His voice trailed behind him. Before they run out, my phone is ringing. Otherwise, he gave a shrug with his shoulders. I wouldn't want my daughter to worry. She's been trying to reach me for days. Oh, yes, it's like that, said Mrs. Weiss. Go, hurry. They always call when you're not home. Maybe you'll invite me in for coffee tomorrow, new? My door is always open, she said. Coffee and a piece of mandelbread. You could sure use a cup of coffee. The coffee at What's Cooking tasted bitter this morning. Was that only this morning? When that waitress questioned him about the tip? She had no business making a fool of him like that. Well, she got what she deserved. Boy, was he hungry. After he got off the phone, he'd peel himself an orange. Had he really smelled pot roast? Walk, he told himself. Walk faster. His legs were hardly moving. He didn't want to miss Cheryl's phone call. Cheryl, his buddy Williger, whoever. Sometimes he got phone calls for solicitations. Could he please give $10 to Misericordia? Children with Tay-Sachs disease needed his help. The girl's voice was young and eager. She sounded like a college student. He wondered if she lived in the neighborhood. Can we count on you, she said. Can you count on me, Jack thought. He reached for his checkbook and he gave. Now he fumbled in his pocket for the keys. Behind him, he heard the whoosh of Mrs. Weiss's door, the catch of her lock. In front, he saw the end of the tunnel like a stop sign, number 1601. The last one on the right. One more second, he'd be there. Yellow light from the wall fixtures lit up the way. Outside his door, the phone was as loud as Larry's car alarm. He'd heard it once when he went out to L.A. to visit. Some beat-up jalopy had barely kissed Larry's bumper. What kind of car is this? Jack had asked. His son drove an MG. It's a classic, Larry said. Do you like it? L.A. Larry, M.G. Mogul, Jack laughed. Wasn't that funny? But Larry didn't think so. He hoisted the groceries on his hip, and a naval orange jumped out of the bag, bouncing off his fingers to the carpet. He almost tripped on it. You could have broken your leg, he imagined Larry saying as he reached out to steady himself. The groceries flew all over. $20 worth of fruit and frozen food rolling down the hallway. There was Sports Illustrated with Larry Bird's ugly mugshot staring up at him. Shit, he muttered under his breath. So Mrs. Weiss shouldn't hear. Get to the phone. Just leave it. He'd been looking for the keys. Keep looking for the keys. In the creases of his pocket, he felt the roll of quarters he'd picked up at the bank for poker tomorrow night. Lifesavers, some loose change. Then he searched around in the other pocket, wadded bills, Bic pen, finally the round metal ring of the keys. He wiped his lips. Perspiration fell onto his collar from his chin. He needed a shave. He hadn't shaved this morning. Later on, he'd give himself a shave. First, he pushed his way straight into the kitchen, to the wall phone mounted next to the hanging plant. He lifted up the receiver. It was cold on his ear. The smell of oranges came up to him, a cloud around his head. When he listened, no one was there. Jack waited until night. That was the one thing he could do. He could wait. Maybe they'd call back. Maybe they'd try again in a couple minutes. That's what he would do. Call back. Pick up the phone again. 1 minute someone isn't home yet, and the next they walk in the door. The door shuts. The lock catches. They throw their groceries on the kitchen table. They look in the refrigerator, scan the shelves, peel themselves an orange. That's how it happens. The refrigerator hums. The toilet flushes. That's what separates you from the silence. First the silence is crowding in on you, and then you hear the telephone ringing. The phone could ring at any minute. Jack was patient. He would wait. In the meantime, he turned on the TV and watched Jeopardy, his favorite program. He rested his arm on the arm of the couch where Muriel's cigarette had once burned a hole in it and fingered the burnt brown edge. The fabric flaked in his fingers. On Jeopardy, they give the answers, even if you don't know what to ask. He pulled out a stack of greeting cards from the desk drawer and started to rummage through them. Birthday, Father's Day, anniversary cards, Muriel's condolences. Jack kept them all throughout the years. Each one had a date on the envelope because he wanted to keep track. Now he picked up an old Father's Day card, sent the year before Larry decided he liked salt water better than fresh. "We couldn't do without you, Dad." Turning on the light, Jack read the fine print. When the Weight Watchers commercial came on, he hurried into the kitchen. By now, the Lean Cuisine chicken breast entrees were running with sweat. He shoved the frozen food into the freezer. He pushed the heads of lettuce into the bin. Back in the den, he looked at the telephone he'd had installed so he wouldn't have to run to the kitchen to answer. He imagined that the minute someone was calling, the phone would light up like the one at the car wash. It would leap out at him, one line after another, and he would see all the buttons turning red. After the evening news, he couldn't wait any longer. No one ever called after 10. An L train had jumped the tracks at Clark and Lake, the reporters said. Two cars hung over the edge. He clicked off the remote and shuttled into the living room. He stood in front of the picture window, just like the real estate agent told him. He took in the view, like she said. From the 16th floor, he could see anything, or as much as he wanted. He even thought he saw stars. When he squinted, the sky was full of them, lights blinking, flashing away. He leaned forward with his fingers splayed against the window frame. What should he do? Shout hip hip hooray? Instead, he went into the dining room table where he kept all his paperwork. He felt in his pocket for the pen. Fat chance the insurance company would ever call him, so he reached for his checkbook and paid the overdue plate glass insurance bill right there and then. Thank you.